Jones.
Nora is the one guy.
Hello! Yeah. Go!
And he, that would be just
we
like
got Eric Cartoon. Ledee in the house and Crazy Cat. I'm G Money Moss, and you're with Wonka.
Hold it, everyone. I need to announce to some of you who may not know this yet that Wonkcast is producing three episodes a week. On Mondays, we produce our standalone Below the Fold series. On Wednesdays, we do a deep dive into a policy with a guest. And on Saturdays, we post our live recording with WRGW, George Washington University's radio station. If you want to hear us live, listen in on Fridays from 6:30 to 7 p.m. at WRGW's website or on iHeartRadio. Lastly, in the following episode, we speculate how the discussed provision of the new tax law may be implemented and express areas for excitement and concern from a policy standpoint. To clarify, this is a new provision. This is a new law. We do not know exactly how the provision will be implemented, nor can we definitively know if our projected concerns will be seen. Thank you. Enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Wonkcast, the independent studio podcast of the GWU Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. We are here today to talk with student Lorena Roque about economic and regional inequality and the new tax law passed by Congress. I am here today with my co-hosts and with me, Eric Ledoux. Joining me also is
Gabe Moss.
And Kat Lundy.
And our guest today, Lorena Roque.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Lorena, what do you study?
I'm concentrating on economic policy and energy policy.
Thanks for joining us today. What's the skinny on this tax law? Why have we gathered here today?
So essentially, as we all know, this tax bill was very controversial in December with being passed and with the Republican. Basically, the controversial or what was believed to be the controversial tax bill was passed in December. But there are provisions in the tax bill that would actually do a lot of good for the U.S. And so the provision 130, known as the Investing in Opportunity Act, got changed to the Opportunity Zones provision in the tax bill. Essentially, what it does is that companies and corporations can defer capital gains to what is called an opportunity fund. And these opportunity funds are allocated to low-income tracts.
So an opportunity zone, is that just like a geographic location, like a county, a city? Like, what defines an opportunity zone?
So opportunity zones are what the census defines as a census tract, which is essentially a neighborhood. So a little bit bigger than a zip code, but an essentially a neighborhood.
When I was reading about this from what you sent us, one thing that I found very problematic was I didn't see strong language defining what this capital investment would be and like what it would look like. There was talk of banks and other companies that already have investment in specific neighborhoods being able to grow that investment tax-free, but I didn't actually see anything saying this is going to local businesses and local investors' hands. My thought is this might wind up being some sort of tax write-off for companies to just expand into low-income areas where the land is very, very cheap and people are very, very easy to push out. And this might just be gentrification writ large, right? Just like on this huge scale in disadvantaged communities picked up by the federal government.
Are there specifications about what these investments can be?
Yes. So essentially, the implementation is taking place right now. And essentially, right now, governors, state governors can nominate 25% of their low income, what's considered a low income census tract, for nomination of an opportunity zone by March 21st. So then corporations defer capital gains to these zones. And then essentially, this ties back to entrepreneurship and business establishment, which is why the organization who came up with the opportunity zones, Economic Innovation Group, they realm it into the economic inequality aspect, because economic inequality is a function of our entrepreneurship. So ever since the 1970s, entrepreneurs and business establishments have been on decline. And that's a really big part of concentrating economic wealth in America. For instance, in the classical school of economics, it tells us that consumers prefer monopolies because they have less choice and therefore they are more efficient, economically speaking. However, that decreases competition, and you know, this is back to the Amazon conglomerate, or essentially now entrepreneurs, they don't pitch companies, or they don't pitch companies to venture capitalists for profitability. They pitch it for to be acquired by bigger companies. And what this provision in the tax bill and what the intent behind this organization is to build competition and to foster innovation.
So back to my previous question, is this then, there's language that aims this capital investment at local people, right? So it's not like you can take this capital and invest it yourself. It's more you put the capital aside into a grant and then people in the community can pull from the grant.
Exactly, which is why this is written at such a low level of geography, rather than having it be that this money is just allocated to the state and governors can just distribute these funds however it is. It's not. It's to these communities, to these neighborhoods at this low level of geography.
With these funds or this pool of money, would it be like someone in a small town in Georgia, I want to use this to open my own restaurant, or I want to build a McDonald's franchise? Is there a specification on the types of businesses or industries where this money can go?
I'm definitely not sure of the specific language that is going to be used in the implementation. But like I said, I think it's definitely at the entrepreneurship level. This bill was very heavily supported by the Small Business Committee in the House. And a lot of their concerns with entrepreneurs and business establishments in America is that entrepreneurs do not have access to capital. And so what's different about this program than, say, the New Market Tax Credit, which is not on the tax bill, is that these are funds that will be seen on a 10-year term.
I'm guessing it's kind of targeted around small suburbs, small cities, towns, that sort of thing. Not super suited for rural invest, or would this also be useful in a rural setting? I mean, it just seems like the entrepreneurship requirements in a rural setting are different than a township.
Yeah, so there are two different requirements for being a low income census tract. So if the location or if the census tract is in a metropolitan area, it either has to be 20% below the poverty rate, or it has to be 80% below the median income in a metro area. Outside of a metro area in rural communities, it's 80% of median income. And then...
So the main gist I'm getting from this is that along this topic of regional inequality, it's that you have these super centers where a lot of entrepreneurship and capital is available. Capital is in very specific areas. And when the overall economy was growing a while back, and during the initial stages of this recovery, most of that growth was happening in very specific regions. We're looking at, of course, San Francisco, Silicon Valley as an example, or New York,
DC.
But it wasn't happening in the smaller cities or smaller townships that were going on, or even
like Louisville or Minneapolis. Like, yeah, it's pretty confined, right, to very specific small areas.
Or sometimes it's not even like you could be living in a suburb that's just a few miles away from where all the growth is going. And the point of this is to kind of like encourage that capital get spread out more geographically across America to better distribute it.
Exactly. And a great example of that in terms of government and policy initiatives is that Kansas City, Missouri has actually done a great job of providing initiatives for entrepreneurs and providing workshops and I think they've even started their own fund, their own city fund, where entrepreneurs can access capital. And therefore, Kansas City is growing. A large number of people are moving there now. That is what this bill and the provision under this bill is supposed to do, is to increase competition and kind of spur that entrepreneurship is important in America.
Let's say I'm a business venture capitalist, maybe, or just big investor. I have a lot of capital gains coming my way. I don't want to pay a lot in capital gains tax, and I want to make use of this program. How does it pay dividends to me? I get that the money I invest in it, if I keep it there for long enough, is either subject to reduced capital gains tax or no capital gains tax. But what's the actual return? If this is going into like a grant type system, how do I get the benefit of that?
So from what I understand, for example, you have unrealized capital gains. Rather than putting it into the stock market or a mutual fund, that's where the tax incentive comes in. Under this provision, the interest and the dividends that you would be paying in tax if you put it in the stock market isn't there.
I'm sorry, what is this fund called again? Or what
an
is this
opportunity fund? And to quote an example provided by the Economic Innovation Group. So say you have $100 of unrealized capital gains in your stock portfolio. You decide to reinvest those gains to an O fund, or as we said, opportunity fund, that invests in distressed areas of your home state. And you decide to hold this for a 10-year period. So you can either hold it for a 5-year period, a 7-year period, a 10-year period. That is within the provision. So you're able to defer the tax that you owe on your original $100 of capital gains until 2026. Therefore, the basis is increased by 15%, so effectively reducing your $100 of taxable capital gains to 85%. So you will owe $20 of tax on your original capital gains when the bill is finally implemented. In addition, you'll hold your O fund investment for 10 years, and you'll owe no capital gains tax on its appreciation. So let's assume that your O fund investment grows 7% annually, and the after-tax value of your original $100 investment in 2028 is $176. So you've enjoyed a 5.8% effective annual return compared to the 2.8% equivalent of just holding it in the stock market.
Okay, so to break that apart, are these guaranteed at 7%? Is that what they're saying, that like these will be offered at 7% interest?
It says 7% appreciation rate. Yeah,
I mean, okay, that you'll get. That's a great
yeah.
Way
I mean,
to do it.
Is that set in stone? I really don't know, but
that's at least this is from the group that created the
yes.
the concept, right? So and in their theoretical model, there's a set guaranteed rate of return that is higher than the natural rate of interest and the expected rate of inflation.
Yes, that's exactly, which is, you know, it's market driven. And that's yeah. what's different about the similar bill that is not included, which is a new market tax credit, because that was a credit given to entrepreneurs, which, as we've just talked about with incentives, people are driven by incentives. If I'm given a credit to do something, I never see that money. I just assume that it's on my little card. Here, you're saying for a 10-year period, you have actual feasible money and capital that you can invest to your business. That creates incentives for entrepreneurship. That and also creates incentive for companies or people who have unrealized capital gains. You want to see your money grow, just like we want to see these distressed communities grow.
So then I'm guessing the other side of this is entrepreneurs have to pay back at some rate, because if they're borrowing from this fund, that's the only way the fund can give back dividends and grow. Do you have any information on the rate of interest for borrowing startup costs from this fund?
It's never stated that they've had to pay anything back.
Okay, then I'm not sure how there would be returns on this. Like if it's, you know, like I'm just thinking like the money has to, if you put money into the fund mm-hmm. and then the money gets taken out of the fund and spent on a business, the business has to pay that fund back so that the investor can get their money
yeah.
back, right? If that doesn't happen, then there's not a 7% rate of return
yeah,
unless the state is subsidizing matching funds and just paying you for what you said you put in, which I don't think
yeah.
is happening.
No, I think you're right. They would have to pay it back, but no, I have absolutely no.
So that makes me think that it must be at least equal to the rate of, well, no, that math doesn't necessarily work.
It would have to have a higher rate of return than the rate of interest, because then there would be no incentive
yeah.
to actually invest in it.
I like the idea of having an alternative to, like, well, it sounds like something that I could just throw some money at, right?
Exactly,
and
which is the point. It's not the fact that, you know, you're losing from this.
Well, no, so that for the investor side, this is like an awesome thing. This is a really good, really solid, basically an accessible treasury bond. Right? You can just sit your money in it 5, 7, 10 years. It pays off back to you. You don't have to pay a lot of taxes to the government. It's good. But for the entrepreneur who might be in Kansas City and might not have that many options for investment from a bank or from other capitalists, they're looking at this rate, and this might be the only option they have. And I'm worried or wondering really like what that rate would look like in practice and if it would be feasible for a startup business to be expected to pay that rate on the capital borrowed, right? Just if we're expecting a really constant rate of return for the overall fund.
Yeah.
I don't know, expect any answer on that. I'm just, this is like going on in my head.
I'm just worried about
small businesses paying that money back.
I hear this and I'm thinking about like what's been going on in the world of like microfinancing for developing nations mm-hmm. to build and promote entrepreneurialism and like small businesses that, you know, it turns out you give someone who like wants to start like a clothing company in a developing country like $100 and they can easily make up that return because growth is so quick. I'm curious about what that effect is when you're going to an economically disadvantaged part of America.
Wait, hang on, I need to stop you there. Microfinance really doesn't work. It's incredibly abusive. The rates are very, very high because the only way to see your return on your capital invested is to charge high rates because so many of those businesses do actually fail. And oftentimes in these communities, the only people that can get credit are women, and they're often abused by men in their lives to get access to the capital. The men use the capital, don't pay it back because they're not the ones whose names are on the bill. Women are taken to debtor's prison. So, I mean, I'm generalizing here, but it's not.
Yeah.
We should not import this system. Like it was seen as a good thing in the 90s, but has been shown to actually be a very predatory and abusive system of investment because it is driven by profit, and the only way that companies can earn a profit on that investment is to charge very high rates of return that are not realistically achievable. But the people in those countries don't have access to banking, so they don't actually have access to any other alternative.
I know like that... Me. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I know that, and I probably have to do more research on this, I know that the USAID actually has programs specifically designed for, here is, you know, pick country A, here is $1 million that we will guarantee for you to donate to small businesses. Problem is that the USAID didn't necessarily, when they created this program, didn't necessarily have like a, all right, we're going to check in and evaluate, are these loans being fulfilled? Are, you know, then they have all these really strict requirements. You can't do this in order to get the money. You can't do anything illegal. You can't have committed a crime. It can't be a business that hurts people, or, you know, I'm not really sure what all their requirements are, but obviously good in incentive. And now the USAID has an evaluations team set up to make sure that the money that they're giving and guaranteeing basically for some of these countries to help microfinance and create, like, I want to build a bodega or a clothing company. I think that, you know, it might not be the only microfinancing. I'm sure there's private venture capitalist groups that probably are taking advantage of as people, but I think there is a little sliver of hope in terms of
there are groups that are trying to do alternatives to microfinance that function on similar premises of giving small amounts of money to a large group of people. And there are groups in the United States that do that with people in the United States. The key is the ability to say, we don't expect a return. Right, USAID is able to say we don't expect a return. Microfinance was largely driven by groups that expected a rate of return. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, if we're seeing this program is led by capital investment, that to me says that it expects a rate of return. And that's scary because the reason why it's being loaned out is because they don't have an alternative. Mm-hmm. So that gets me a little agitated, but I'm hoping that there is actually a plan for...
Yeah, and I think that it's important to mention that, like I said, it is market-driven, it is market-responsive. So, for example, governors, they do have to... Well, 90% of the fund has to go to low-income communities. However, they can choose where this will be most beneficial in their state, such as new capital, habitually, you know, for local entrepreneurs, connection to markets, population centers, and anchor institutions to facilitate growth in distressed localities. However, this is really flexible, so they can choose to attract a mix of investments to new businesses, infrastructure, and real estate or rental housing. So, for example, some states will want to designate an opportunity zone on, you know, the edge of a university in order to encourage technology hubs. The language in this provision is used so specifically to low income areas is because it can only 90% of these of this money has to go to low income. Mm-hmm. Zones or low income neighborhoods.
So the one thing that's coming into my head just after you said that, what's to stop, say, like, I want to use DC as an example, but we'll use DC as an example. So like Ward 7 or 8, which ward is in Southeast, what would be stopping governors to be like, okay, governors in Florida, here's Miami-Dade County, this is our big metropolitan hub, What's the closest low-income area that's right next to Miami-Dade? Because if I'm thinking long-term, I actually want to almost build the metropolitan out, or metropolitan area out as much as possible. What is the likelihood of some of this money actually going to middle of nowhere? I know people live there, but middle of nowhere, Florida, where they're nowhere near any like major city. Is it just going to actually create, could it accidentally or unintentionally actually make metropolitan areas even bigger than they are now, subsequently making some of these smaller impoverished areas even more, create even more disparity between the two areas of the state?
Yeah, I think that there's two things from that I want to say from what you just addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Is, yeah, that's definitely in terms of me studying economic policy. And what I found is that a lot of organizations and think tanks in DC have these great research on what we can do to spur entrepreneurship, business establishment, and close the gap between inequalities. However, a lot of community development has run into the problem. DC is a perfect example of gentrification, and no one has. And if you want to define gentrification in loose terms, it's essentially that, you know, we quote unquote develop these areas and the rent increases and people who are low to moderate income are displaced and have to move out. And so that, I think, is something that I've not seen a lot of research on or a solution to this ongoing problem. The second, there's a provision on like qualifying opportunity zones and how, like, if you're next to an urban area. So I'm going to look for that.
So I will say that the requirement that 90% of the funds be allocated to low-income areas will kind of prevent that sort of suburb creep, because suburbs are not low-income areas, right? So if you look at Miami-Dade, the low-income areas are inside the city, so there's not actually like an ability to really grow the outside, unless you're going to the rural area outside Miami-Dade, which might be classified as a low-income area. I think that buffer of suburb might work against that push. Just thinking about, you're going to run out of funds to invest if you're only using 10% of your total funds in that push. But you do raise an interesting point, which is, I still think these funds are going to largely be allocated to towns and small metropolitan areas, not to rural areas, which admittedly don't have the majority of the population living in them, but are still areas that are significantly lacking investment and also wouldn't necessarily benefit the same way as a township from entrepreneurial investment, right? What they might need might look different in terms of funds allocated than just traditional entrepreneurial startup fund and venture capitalism.
Yeah, and you also throw in the uphill battle for a lot of rural areas in terms of access to infrastructure, because, you know, a dollar in entrepreneurship in an urban area where you have broadband and whatnot, that goes a lot farther than you try to drop a dollar of entrepreneurship in middle of nowhere, and it's like, you know, trying to start a business and you're already five steps behind someone else who started a business on like the edge of like the LA suburbs or something.
So you did mention investment in infrastructure and housing when you were reading through what the bill is targeting. I kind of wonder, I mean, we were talking earlier about returns on investment. I'm kind of wondering how infrastructure investment would play into that. I mean, I know the Trump administration has talked a lot about its toll roads and toll bridges idea, but I can't imagine a $1.50 toll on a rural bridge would pay for the investment needed to build that bridge. It doesn't seem like that sort of investment would happen.
Well, for $1.50 going across a bridge, maybe what these funds need are is, you know, you get your money back 200 years later, but we don't tax it at all. I wonder how many people would go for that.
Super rest invest.
In terms of the nuances of like tax policy, is that the interest and of being an O fund, or as well as the actual capital gains, that's not being taxed. So you're winning either way.
You're not being taxed on the gains, yeah, that you would get from putting money in this fund. When the money is released, you're just paying taxes on the principal.
Exactly.
When you first got it, you're paying old taxes, not new taxes. So you're paying that same amount of taxes you would have had, but now it's on a higher fund, and it's the nominal amount of what that tax would be, correct?
Yes.
Not the percentage. So it doesn't increase with the increasing amount of money that you now get back.
Exactly.
Hmm.
It's a great system. I just wonder how the return is supposed to work from getting the money back from the entrepreneurs. That's still, for me, like a big holdup. Now, an alternative to this could be, what you could do is you could just, as a government, take all capital gains taxes and put them into this fund, right? So then you don't actually, you're still taxing businesses. You're still doing that. It's annoying, but you're still taxing capital gains. But you then use all those capital gains taxes to invest in rural areas, in underdeveloped areas. And you do it like USAID with debt-free funding. So either grace loans that you don't expect to be paid back, or some sort of, you know, market interest, just inflation, zero interest fund.
This bill or this provision expects the companies to grow. Therefore, you know, your return will...
And there probably will be a lot of companies that grow, but there will be a lot of companies that can't, right? That's just, that is how we've structured our economy. We expect a lot of businesses, if not most businesses, to fail within their first couple of years. It is how the market decides the best businesses, or whatever we want to say about that. So that means there's going to be a lot of people who have borrowed a lot of money that don't see that money paying off and are then expected to pay that money back plus interest to investors.
So, Lorena, does this policy mention anything about what would happen in that circumstance, or is that going towards the fuzzy line between policy versus implementation of the policy?
I think it's bridging the implementation of the policy because in the research that has been there in terms of covering this policy and kind of alleviating the gap in America, and you know, a big part of the conversation in the election of 2016 was the quote-unquote Trump County and how you know, rural communities are being left behind and low-income areas are left behind. I think Gabe brought up a great point about, well, that happens in our economy, is that, you know, competition, we filter out, or the best competitor wins. But that's the problem. And so if we don't try to increase competition, it's just never going to be there. And, you know, we're all going to shop at Amazon and never leave our house.
Price out those businesses and then take over the market. Same thing as what Uber and Lyft.
I mean, that's what's going on with all tech companies. Everything, every new innovation on your iPhone doesn't come from Apple. Apple bought that idea. Entrepreneurs, or at least tech entrepreneurs, from what I understand, this might just be my bias, they don't care about being the next Apple. They care about how much Apple can pay them
for
their idea. Exactly, for a patent, for their idea. And then they can just, you know, chill and walk away.
I feel like what this fund is trying to do is it's trying to bring back a little bit of that, what old school investment used to be, which was you went to a bank, the bank assessed like how the business you were proposing, what you wanted to do with it, and what, and worked with you to figure out what would be an appropriate amount that they'd be willing to give you, and what would be a fair, sometimes fair, interest rate. But the idea is that, you know, it's not just I'm building this company for the sake of making more money from it. I'm going to build a business, and then what they pay back to the bank is like a long-term payment process to the bank.
To just address how many Americans, approximately, and according to the Economic Innovation Group, and to quote the American Community Survey, in a five-year estimate from 2011 to 2015, 50 million people in the U.S. live in an economically distressed area.
50 million.
50 million Americans. So in total, we have approximately 74,000 census tracts. Around 32,000 of those are considered low or distressed, economically speaking. So that's around 43%. Of neighborhoods that are distressed. And we don't see that in the economic indicators. You know, I was reading today a stat that unemployment is at 4.1%. But if you go to Detroit, that's not true.
Also, unemployment is calculated based on people recently looking for work, right?
Exactly.
So if you're in one of these distressed areas, it might be that you've given up on the formal labor economy a long time ago and you're not calculated in
exactly.
the labor pool.
Yeah, and, you know, we can go into the nuances of, you know,
I mean, this is going back in implementation, but just like making sure that this money is actually used well, so that when you invest it into an area, it will create a self-sustaining economic engine in the place you put it into. Because right now, I mean, so much of every time I think about how to benefit another area, I think about, oh, how can you get a metro line out there? Or how can you connect it to where the economic activity is? But like trying to, you know, it's the difference between like getting a flame from one fire pit and moving it over to like a new fire pit. versus like trying to start a fire from scratch.
Exactly. And I think that that's the intention of this bill. But I mean, as policy students, we all know that it comes back to implementation. And I think whenever we talk about money, there is always, or taxes in general, there's always the risk of corruption. There's always the risk of losing.
Well, certainly if the governor is arbitrarily picking a quarter of their
targeted
census tracts, I mean, that to me says there is something questionable going on here.
But they have to, they have to be
approved.
They have to be approved.
Yeah, well, so like let's say you're California, right? There is a wide range of possibilities where you want to invest that. Is it in the Central Valley? If it is, then you're investing in traditionally conservative, mostly white communities, right? Or are you investing it in Los Angeles, which has an incredibly diverse population, but is also highly economically disadvantaged? You might be able to say both are the same thing, but investing in Orange County benefits a very different group of people and boosts a very different constituency than investing in, say, South Central, right? They're very different places that might look the same if you're a California regulator just trying to say, okay, they were picking a quarter of the plots, you know.
I wanted to add something, and I don't know if this plays into it at all, but I know, like, for some startups, Pittsburgh is becoming a big place where startups are coming up because the city's fun. It's, well, I've never actually been there. I'm sure someone would say Pittsburgh is fun. But one of the things that I'm thinking about is some of these areas, I don't necessarily see a lot of big tech startups that they have now capital, or say there's like a coder out in middle of nowhere, flyover country. Because I know if I was looking for work, there are probably parts of the country that are the last places I would look in terms of my quality of life, what I have access to in terms of extracurricular things, or
so maybe what we need to do is we need to use the fund to help move people in the known economic areas to the economic
in terms of governors nominating low-income census tracts, I think that's where the politics come into the policy, where you can definitely choose, you could definitely, you know, say, I want to help this type of demographic rather than this type of demographic. And, you know, in terms of what they're strategically allowed to pick, it is, from my understanding, anything that is considered a low-income census tract. However, they only have 90 days to nominate census tracts, and they can ask for an extension. And from my understanding, everyone is going to use the extension as of right now, because It's very much in the working process and the implementation process.
To Kat's question, this is not something that's aimed at people with high levels of economic mobility. I mean, this could be used to start the next Texas Instruments, but likely it's going to be local businesses, bookshops, grocery stores, maybe schools, small things that are needed for a community but are not necessarily designed to attract outside hires. Okay. And I don't think they should be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if we're talking about the ideal policy scenario here, this is locals borrowing funds to hire locals to provide services for locals. No one is displaced, the community is elevated. That I think is the fantasy here that we're trying to achieve, right? That's our golden target.
Exactly. So if you want to take an example, we could take DC as an example. In terms of an economically distressed area, that's pretty much nowhere other than Southeast DC. People in DC aren't going to all of a sudden be like, oh, let's move to the Southeast because that's new. There's only two DC census tracts that are low income now.
I guess when I'm thinking about implementation, I feel like investment would go further for an area to boost its economy or its local economy if it was multiple businesses at one time, because in my head I'm getting confused thinking about here's a fund to build a new shop or build a new grocery store, which benefits a small fraction of the people in the community. There will be people working at the grocery store, but what about everyone else who has nothing to do with that business that still can't shop there, that still can access it through infrastructure?
We're ideally talking about a multi-million-dollar fund, so it's not just
per opportunity.
It's not just like this low, like $3,000 estimate.
Cool. Yeah. Now the question is, how are those funds divvied up? Is this a federal pot that is then disseminated to states, or is it state by state? Because if it's state by state, I don't know necessarily how many Californians, for instance, are going to invest their capital gains in Nebraska. Not that there's anything wrong with Nebraska, not that Californians are inherently selfish.
That's
a
good question.
I just think that we're just wired to think about our local area, and we tend to think pretty, you know, insularly.
It's definitely going to be state-driven,
yeah,
from what I understand, in terms of that it's the governors allocate these funds, and then the governors nominate these neighborhoods, and then those neighborhoods will be the ones targeted in opportunity zones.
Then attracting the funds, right? I mean, that's going to be a big issue for low-income states, highly rural states that don't already have a lot of capital investment. I mean, even for a state like Chicago that has...
A state like Chicago.
Chicago is a state. I'm from Chicago.
even for a state like Illinois that has Chicago, right, getting investment out of the Chicago area is going to be really difficult, right? Because you're limited by how much capital investment is already parked in Chicago businesses. And there's a lot of need in and around Chicago, right? So I'm just thinking, like, you know, California might be able to spread its wealth. Washington might be able to spread its wealth. Texas might be able to spread its wealth in New York. But for states with smaller capital gains economies, this might present a really challenging proposition to truly drive up funds to grow their businesses.
Yeah. And that's where I think that the impact is very important to take into account, or the potential impact, and why implementation is so important, because the New Market Tax Credit, I saw the Government Accountability Office ran a report on how effective it was, and it really wasn't. And it gave people, you know, when that policy was written, it was essentially almost the same intention of entrepreneurship, increasing businesses, and those communities where the New Market Tax Credit was intended for, they didn't grow. It didn't help.
Looking ahead into the future, who are the implementers that we should be looking at and keeping an eye on as this gets rolled out? You mentioned the Treasury, right?
Yeah, so the Department of Treasury is going to be in charge of opportunity zones, or...
where they are.
Yeah, defining where they are. The nominations, the neighborhoods that governors nominate will be going to the Department of Treasury.
Mm-hmm. So it's the Treasury, governors... And is there any other department or agency involved in this?
Not to my knowledge. Ideally, I think it would be great to get, you know, local governments in the implementation process or in the disbursement of these funds. I think that is imperative to everything that we've talked about on this episode, is that, you know, it's like when people say all politics is local politics. Well, all economics is local economics.
Yeah.
So Lorena, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today about this really important subject about the well-being of our entire country economically and in tax policy.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure on the WonkCast.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will be right back with our host's personal reactions to this thrilling conversation. Hello, everyone. We are back. Our guest is gone, but our feelings and thoughts about the discussion remain. And now, this is the portion of our episode where we talk about how we felt about this discussion and any other closing thoughts we may have. Kat, Gabe, thoughts, feelings?
I think that Gabe and Lorena brought up good points in terms of the politics of this being in the tax bill. It wasn't something that I heard about until Lorena told me about it herself and how it had bipartisan support, but the fact that it was tacked on to all of these other policies that Democrats have problems with.
It raises the eyebrow.
Yeah.
I was asking a lot of questions about it because I am worried about how this fund is expected to appreciate value. You know, how that rate of return is supposed to occur. And I am really worried that what this could turn into is essentially microfinancing for impoverished communities in the United States. Abusive, parasitic loans that maybe not intended to be parasitic, but need to be at a high enough rate of interest where realistically the majority of loan takers will not be able to pay back the loan. Or the state governments could be expected to subsidize the value of the loan so that the loan can be offered at low to no interest and the state pays back the interest to the investor. In that case, what we're essentially doing is subsidizing capital investment with no actual tangible large-scale benefit, right? The state government is paying you back your capital gains dividends, right? Not only is it writing off your taxes, it's spending tax money to make it so that your investment on your capital gains continues to accrue over a 10-year period. That to me seems incredibly unfair and highly one-sided in that it advantages incredibly wealthy people over the people it's actually targeted at.
This goes back to my personal interest is in who is actually in charge of managing this, mm-hmm. and what will be the task force or the team that actually implements this. I can totally see it going down this dystopian path of suddenly the United States is the one that has to like hound people to get them to pay back their loans. Maybe the United States starts, if like the returns aren't happening, you sell the debt to someone else. And suddenly we're just back in the problem of quick loans to people in impoverished areas.
I don't necessarily know if this is going to be quick loans, but I mean, what makes venture capitalism function is that you can lose your venture capital, right? Your capital funds only accrue value if the company succeeds, right? Venture capitalists make their living by making a targeted guess at how many investments it'll take to get a rate of return. Maybe it's 2 in 50, I should have said 1 in 25, actually turn into a real company. But if they invest with the right requirements for repayment or stock dividends, they will see a return on that total pool of 25 investments, even if 24 out of the 25 go pear-shaped. But the problem with this is it's intended to be a long-term, stable growth investment, which to me means that it's not actually going to be handled the way normal venture and angel capitalism works, right? It's going to be handled as a regular loan-based system, which means the only way that the government is going to be able to pay back this money to the capital investors is through return payments on the loan. Right, so people will be held responsible for this money as opposed to normal venture capitalism where if you lose it, you lose it. But if you're paying into a grant fund that's supposed to return a guaranteed interest and then pay you back at the end of the grant, that inherently assumes that the investment is stable, which means there must be some mechanism to hold the loan party accountable.
Like a betting process? You back.
I'm thinking more either some form of what's it called a principal guarantee for the loan, right? So, like a mortgage, right? The principal is the house, right? The bank can take your house if you fail to pay. Some form of that. If there is none of that, then typically what happens is a very high rate of interest to accommodate the high rate of risk of these investments.
Isn't that part of the microfinancing abuses, though? These are people willing to give loans out to anyone that needs them.
Yeah. That's the thought is design loans that are supposed to be given out to people who need them. But the problem is without a government or an incredibly wealthy, generous company, you don't actually have the ability to loan out large sums of money to a large amount of people who have a high risk portfolio. It's just most of them are not going to be able to pay you back.
But you're also operating under the assumption that all of these loans that are going out are going to be high risk. I don't know necessarily they're all being high risk.
Maybe the vetting process will be so thorough that no one will qualify for them anyway.
It could be. That's a very good point. I am making this assumption just under general loan ideas. My thought on them being relatively high risk is simply given the rate of failure for startup businesses. I'm assuming that these are mostly going to be startup businesses because that's the language of the group that founded this idea, right? They want it to be about entrepreneurship and business. That has a high rate of failure. The reason why it works is because it's powered by money that's not expected to be paid back in most of the cases. But this fund is designed to pay back money. And that is where this disconnect is happening for me. We're talking about investing in food deserts, investing in areas with extremely high poverty, rural areas that have very low infrastructure investment. I just like it doesn't seem like this the starting point of how to get investors to invest in it makes a lot of sense. Solid rates of return, you can bank on it, but the actual connection to benefiting a community I see it as potentially very tenuous.
This sounds like, from everything you've just listed, it sounds like that this policy might work in tandem with other policies to handle, to help alleviate these issues in these areas. And including what I was talking about earlier, the whole thing about infrastructure. And how, like, you know what, if there's not a clear roadway to get to this, like, separated township in, like, the middle of West Virginia, then it's hard to get anything else out there.
Mm. Yeah, infrastructure spending is needed, and that includes housing infrastructure, right? It's really hard to grow your workforce if there just isn't available affordable housing. You need investment in hospitals and schools to attract people to the area and make the area livable. And then you need startup investment. You need investment that's designed to be, you know, very low payback, designed to just jumpstart businesses so that this form of investment can then grow those businesses.
I think one thing we're all in agreement on is that this could be a very mismanaged policy if not done correctly.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
This could be either the star NASCAR, or it can be the car that crashes and burns.
Yeah.
And then the people who own the insurance policy on the car get a lot of money. Because
if these funds
are not used, they still vest. Right. They're still interest-free funds for anyone who puts their money into them. These are still great institutions for parking your investment if you don't have a necessary avenue for that investment to go in. The Americans who invest the most money in it will gain the most by far, exponentially, over that 5, 7, or 10-year period.
Yeah.
And because it's guaranteed and safe.
Well, on that happy note...
So everyone, we're going to keep an eye out on this and see whether or not this car makes it to the finish line or if it crashes and burns. And you know, we at Wonkcast will continuously observe and comment on it.
Thanks for coming to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. Send us love letters and hate mail. Email us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher. Our editors are Eric Ledoux and Eli Richmond, with music by Pele Gunther.